On the table before me lies a solid lump of steel, but in the light of up-to-date science, I know that the atoms of that seemingly inert mass are vibrating with the most intense energy, continually dashing hither and thither, impinging upon and rebounding from one another, or circling round like miniature solar systems with a ceaseless rapidity, whose complex activity is enough to bewilder the imagination. The mass, as a mass, may lie inert upon the table, but so far from being destitute of the element of motion, it is the abode of the never-tiring energy, moving the particles with a swiftness, to which the speed of an express train is as nothing. It is therefore not the mere fact of motion that is the root of the distinction which we draw instinctively between spirit and matter. We must go deeper than that. The solution of the problem will never be found by comparing life with what we call deadness, and the reason for this will become apparent later on. But the true key is to be found by comparing one degree of livingness with another. There is, of course, one sense in which the quality of livingness does not admit of degrees, but there is another sense in which it is entirely a question of degree. We have no doubt as to the livingness of a plant, but we realise that it is something very different from the livingness of an animal. Again, what average boy would not prefer a fox terrier to a goldfish for a pet? Or again, why is it that the boy himself is an advance upon the dog? The plant, the fish, the dog and the boy are all equally alive, but there is a difference in the quality of their livingness, about which no one can have any doubt, and no one would hesitate to say that this difference is in the degree of intelligence. In whatever way we turn, the subject we shall always find that what we call the livingness of any individual life is ultimately measured by its intelligence. It is the possession of greater intelligence that places the animal higher in the scale of being than the plant, the man higher than the animal, the intellectual man higher than the savage. The increased intelligence calls into activity modes of motion of a higher order corresponding to itself. The higher the intelligence, the more completely the mode of motion is under its control. And as we descend in the scale of intelligence, the descent is marked by a corresponding increase in automatic motion, not subject to the control of a self-conscious intelligence. This descent is gradual from the expanded self-recognition of the highest human personality to that lowest order of visible forms which we speak of as things, and from which self-recognition is entirely absent. We see then that the livingness of life consists in intelligence, in other words, in the power of thought. And we may therefore say that the distinctive quality of spirit is thought, and, as the opposite to this, we may say that the distinctive quality of matter is form. We cannot conceive of matter without form. Some form there must be, even though invisible to the physical eye. For matter, to be matter at all, must occupy space, and to occupy any particular space necessarily implies a corresponding form. For these reasons, we may lay it down as a fundamental proposition that the distinctive quality of spirit is thought, and the distinctive quality of matter is form. This is a radical distinction from which important consequences follow, and should, therefore, be carefully noted by the student. Form implies extension in space, and also limitation within certain boundaries. Thought implies neither, when, therefore, we think of life as existing in any particular form, we associate it with the idea of extension in space, so that an elephant may be said to consist of a vastly larger amount.